listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 30th installment of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR, and in particular, we've been talking about the ideological history of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, for sure.
That's right. Good morning, Don.
Good morning.
So, I think today we can sum up an answer, or sum up the question, what is Trotskyism, ideologically?
Right. Good question.
Now, I'll say, from the studies, from the research, that Trotskyism possesses three specific features which contradict Leninism and want to prove or show or indicate that therefore Trotskyism is not Leninism. And this is a very important concept, a very important observation for those people who come to revolution in America through Trotskyism, not knowing, and, they're genuine. People who go to Trotskyism here, who are gathered by the Trotskyist Party, are genuine. I mean, they want change. They want. There's nothing wrong with that.
Some of them.
But they have to realize that it's not Leninism, no matter what they say. They have to. They have to read something other than Trotsky, and right. Check. Which I understand is not always the case. That not much else is read but Trotsky himself. And this is not right. A comparative method.
That's right.
This is not a way of checking against contradictions.
That's absolutely, here's the contradiction at the head end of it, which Stalin wrote about, certainly, and even Lenin posited, which is, if Trotskyism were Leninism, what would be the need for the term Trotskyism, since it's not distinct from Leninism and that term already existed?
That's exactly right. It must be contradictory. It must contradict something in Lenin.
Right.
And
right.
Here we go. The three features. The three features that Trotskyism possesses that we argue contradict Leninism are the following: the theory of permanent revolution, which we will define. A distrust of the party, meaning the party of the revolution, the party that then led the Soviet Union, the Bolshevik Party, a distrust of the party. And the third is the distrust of the leaders. So let's go with permanent revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So permanent revolution. Well, what is permanent revolution in its Trotskyist interpretation?
Hmm. Well, first, it doesn't include the peasants. Right. It doesn't include the peasants.
In Stalin's view, and in Stalin was to Lenin what Engels was to Marx.
Hmm.
A faithful lieutenant, a disciple, although Engels himself had, added to Marx, and so did Stalin.
So did Stalin.
But anyway, sorry, what?
Yeah, so did Stalin. I mean, Stalin added decades of praxis, by the way.
Right.
And a constant reinterpretation.
And he developed socialism in one country, which was a theory in Lenin, that it's possible, in fact necessary, and contrary to what the Trotskyists say, but, don't want to go into too wide a spectrum here. So let's see what this permanent revolution is. It is a revolution that fails to take the poor peasantry into account as a revolutionary force. Trotsky's permanent revolution is, as Lenin said, skipping the peasant movement. Why is this dangerous? Because such a revolution would inevitably have ended in failure.
Right.
For it would have divorced from the Russian proletariat its ally, the poor peasantry.
Yep.
This explains the struggle that Leninism has been waging against Trotskyism ever since 1905, says Stalin.
Yep.
So, you were going to say something.
Yeah, and what's it's interesting because that's exactly the phenomenon that also it guaranteed the success of China's revolution. Because that was, and as a matter of fact, that revolution was organized in the countryside, closing in on the cities, and with an uprising of the urban proletariat towards the end.
Yeah, and look at what, supposing Trotsky had been the leader of the Bolshevik Revolution and had said, all power to the proletariat.
Mm.
You had 80% peasants in Russia, and among these peasants, there were at least three classes.
Right.
And the kulaks would have rebelled, as they did. The middle ones would not have known where to go. They would have gone with the strongest or the one there. And the poor ones would have been left bereft.
Right.
So the point was to gather the peasants into the fold. They were not proletarians. They were not prepared. They were not educated to Marxism. And this also points to the fact that every revolution has contradictions, class contradiction, antagonistic and not antagonistic.
Right.
And these forces, I mean, society of millions of people, everything has to be brought in so that you can then have proletarian state power after You don't begin with a permanent revolution of the
right.
proletariat.
That's right.
You make it along the way. You make it by industrializing the country. You make it by starting schools. Everything that Stalin did in socialism in one country. You know, you make it. It's a process. You don't begin at the beginning.
Right.
Here's the proletariat state, and we have the proletariat revolution.
Right.
What are you going to do with millions of people who have no idea what this is,
right.
who are threatened because they're going to take away the land?
And you know,
right?
for a lot of people, as a matter of fact, for the very class that is supposed to be the most advanced, you know, sector in society, the proletariat, they're the ones who have the most at risk, because A, they have some benefits as an industrial proletariat, and B, they're precarious because they are a proletariat. And so what you're asking them to do is say, well, you know what, that job that you have that you go to every day, let's go on strike and take over the factory, and maybe we can build a socialist society. Maybe you won't have a paycheck next week either. And the state will come along and carry you off to prison.
Yeah, and let's say the peasants decide not to produce grain.
Right.
How is the
now what?
How is
right.
the urban and you make divisions between urban and country.
Right.
That's one of the most dangerous things
of
to do.
Of course it is. Yep.
So then you don't get food to the cities. The proletariat is 5%, the peasantry is 80%, and you're going to have a permanent revolution ipso facto
right.
on
I mean,
the
this
day
is...
that the revolution is. This is idealist thinking. This is
right.
not dialectical. This is
it's not scientific.
This is not dialectical thinking, which is based on change.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. So let's figure out what Marx said, according to quoted, you know, summarized by Stalin. What Marx said about permanent revolution in 1850 or 51, after the defeat of the 48 revolution. So, Marx did not at all propose to begin the revolution, he was talking about Germany, of the 1850s with the immediate establishment of proletarian power.
But how would you do it? How would you do it?
I don't know. It's
by what mechanism?
It's a diktat.
Right. Yep.
You declare you have, and then you go what, on vacation?
Yeah, right.
Everything's
yeah, right.
going to be all right?
Right. You go read it at the steps of, you know, some government building, and then everybody
yeah,
says, oh, okay, no problem, and you win.
Yeah, we have. So what Marx proposed, he proposed that the revolution be crowned by the establishment of proletarian state power. Imagine how much work will go into that. And that means hurling step by step one section of the bourgeoisie after another from the height of power. So whatever were the industrialists, the monopolists in Russia, whatever were the rich peasants, all these contrary forces to the revolution had to be either hurled out, or, in the case of the peasants, brought to be a partner in the revolution.
Right.
So in order to attain after, in order, so, you know, you had to hurl all the reactionary forces out in order, after the attainment of power by the proletariat, that is, the seizure of state power, to kindle the fire of revolution in every country. Mm. You begin with your country, and then you kindle the fire of revolution in every country. I mean, Ho Chi Minh, on the colonial question, as early as 1922, listed the problems in Indochina, the vast territory, the different languages, the prejudice, the horrendous repression, the ignorance of the colonials, you know, of the of the colonized,
right.
the ignorance about Marxism, etc. I mean, it was a tremendous problem.
Yep.
And so, you know, doing a revolution is not a diktat.
Of course.
It's not...
Of
Of course not.
No, it's not something that you can, you know, submit a declaration to a committee, have them approve it, and then implement by, you know, by reading it aloud.
It's idealism, not in the good sense, but in the philosophical sense.
Right. In the metaphysical sense.
Yeah, in the metaphysical sense. That's right. Things are because, you know, I perceive them as such.
Right.
Now you should all perceive the revolution.
Right.
Okay. Secondly, Trotskyism's distrust of the Bolshevik Party principle,
right,
of the monolithic character of the party, of its hostility toward opportunist element. Trotskyism is distrust of the Bolshevik Party. Now, we've seen this for about 10 programs,
right,
10 conversations. We've illustrated that, that Trotsky was for a non-monolithic party, that
right,
is, a pluralistic party of all sorts of elements.
Right.
Anyway, in the sphere of organization, Trotskyism is a theory that revolutionaries and opportunists can coexist and form groups and coterie within a single party. This is the Western idea of a party.
Right. It's a coalition.
Oh, everybody happy.
Yeah, that's right. It's a coalition inside the party. So now, this is different.
Well,
this is different and distinct from, you know, Lenin speaks, or Leninism, basically. The concept is that you have a core group of revolutionaries that are working on the program of, you know, having a revolution
power, yes,
and attaining power for the class, and then governing from that position and defending that from that position.
Yeah,
and
so you're going to admit Nazis?
Right, no. So first you have people that are all with that specific program. That's one test. They, in turn, are to develop themselves and their skills and their ability in relation to the politics of the power politics to actually implement these things. That requires, you know, and the system that they use, democratic centralism, is where everybody is informed about what's happening. They sit down, they determine the broad strokes of what happens, and then you have people managing, this is what we have to do. There's no more dissent. We've decided this among ourselves. Now we go do it. That core then leads the revolution, and so you have the peasants, these workers, these people in the military, that mosh that Trotsky envisions as the party is the revolution led by the party that isn't a mosh, that is a skilled, like an officer class, basically, for that war.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, the idea of this anybody can belong, you can see it in the liberal democracies, which I'm most familiar with,
right,
in Italy. How was the revolution, the social revolution that was implied in the resistance, that was desired in the resistance by at least the communist and the socialist party as well, the communist party, how was it thrown back by the formation of by virtue of the American occupation, hundreds of parties? The monarchists, the fascists, the communists, the socialists, the democrats, the Christian Democrats. This is the idea of a leading revolutionary party? No, this is the arrangement that strangled the revolution, in addition to disarming the communists, etc., and trying to put them outside the law. And finally, you know, as what's his name? Lately, the former head of Woolsey.
Right.
Woolsey? James Woolsey?
Yes.
The former head of the CIA said, yeah, sure, we destabilized the we interfered with the Italian election of 1948 so that the communists wouldn't win.
Right.
And where did they have the support? In about 50 other parties.
Right.
Beginning ruling parties, beginning with the social, with the Christian Democrats.
That's right.
So yep. this is a, you know, if you don't have a leading party that preserves the revolution, you don't have a revolution.
That's right. That's exactly
so
right.
Anyway.
So distrust of the party principle itself, of its monolithic character, and of its hostility towards opportunism. That's the second element of Trotskyism.
That's right. That's right. He was against. So as Stalin points out, he points out to something we've discussed, and he says, we are in no doubt, we are no doubt familiar with the history of Trotsky's August Bloc,
right,
in which various groups,
right,
Martovites, he says, or Soviets and liquidators, we talked about those, but, you know, various grouplets,
right,
of compromisers and Trotskyites happily cooperated,
right,
even though, you know, they had different opposite goals, liquidators and
right,
Otsovis, for example.
Right.
Liquidators wanted to cooperate. The Otsovis wanted not to cooperate with
right,
the provisional government.
Right.
And they cooperated, pretending... No, well, this was before the provisional government. But anyway, happily cooperated, pretending that they were a real party.
Right.
It is well known that this patchwork party pursued the aim of destroying the Bolshevik Party.
Right.
Just as I have argued in the Italian example.
Right. This is exactly the point. The point is that Trotsky will organize with everyone else to kill the actual Communist Party.
Yeah.
That's
right.
That's the essential fact.
Isn't that, yeah, I mean, if you take the essential point, you say, well, geez, yep, this is counter-revolutionary, you
yep,
know. Now look up what we are now, where we are now without a leading party.
Yep. So then we go to the third point, which is the leaders of the Bolshevik Party are also to be distrusted, discredited, and defamed.
And defamed, exactly. And Stalin adds, I do not know of a single trend in the party that could compare with Trotskyism in the matter of discrediting the leaders of Leninism. This is a man who said he was the heir of Lenin, who said that Lenin appointed him as the leader, as his inheritor. And Stalin continues, or the central institution of the party. For example, Trotsky described Lenin as a professional exploiter of every kind of backwardness in the Russian working class movement.
Okay. Now, I mean, okay, yeah. So, and that's what I'm going to say on the one hand, that about you, and on the other hand, I'm going to say I am a Leninist.
I am your baby.
Right, that's right. You're no good, and I'm following you to the ends of the earth.
That's right. So this is what... how it works in the West, the Trotsky movement. I don't know how, whether we even have a Trotsky party. I think the SWP is pretty somnolent. But there are Trotsky's thoughts, because the only thing permitted in the United States, you cannot be a communist.
Right. Yeah, they don't need Trotsky yet. They whip out Trotsky when you start to see workers and others across the society seriously looking at Marx and communism. Then they whip out Trotsky. But right now, they don't need Trotsky because right now the Democratic Party is the left, okay? And liberals are the left. And so Trotsky, compared to them, is actually progressive, even revolutionary, because he at least challenges the assumptions that these others take as a part of their foundational ideology. That is, first, imperialism is just fine. The United States is the exceptional country and should be the global hegemon. And second, socialism is dead. So why would you need Trotsky? And you know, we look at this thing about Trotsky's theory of imperialism, and the question about where he refers to the United States of Europe, that Lenin said, you know, this concept of Trotsky's deeply reactionary substitutes the task of the struggle for socialist revolution with the struggle for the creation of a capitalist federative government. That's the EU. And look at the battle lines in Europe. What do they need Trotsky for? If you're against being in the EU, then you're a reactionary and a racist. And it's, you know, that's where we are. So Trotsky is kind of ahead of the curve at this point in our history.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But as you said at the beginning, the attractiveness of Trotsky, where there is no communism, you know, is that in fact he does talk about revolution, etc.
Right.
He appears attractive.
Right.
He is attractive. So these are the insidious parts.
That's right.
Of the Trotsky legacy.
That's right. I mean, look, particularly now, when you see the conditions that would generate revolution starting to come into place, you have, you know, massive contradictions economically, so that you have, you know, the biggest assemblage of productive capacity in the history of the world, along with global poverty and austerity. When you see a complete loss of confidence, of legitimacy in the institutions and their ability to solve the problems of the societies, being globalized. When you see the conditions that give rise to revolution starting to gather, well, that's when you need to have Trotsky, you know, right there sitting in the chair next to you, because as soon as somebody says revolution and a crowd starts to gather around them, even if it's Bernie Sanders, you need to have somebody there to tell them why the actual revolution isn't something that they can have right now, but rather they should be working on the permanent one, which means the one that will never actually happen. It'll only be in the process of being conducted.
That's right. That's right. So I don't know, you know, I mean, people might have a question of then how come Trotsky, whom Lenin distrusted, who had been an antagonist of the Bolshevik Party, who had been an antagonist of Lenin, how come he came to be in the Bolshevik Revolution? Mm-hmm. And Stalin explains that he found himself in the ranks of the Bolsheviks during the October Movement. It happened because at that time Trotsky did abandon, Stalin emphasizes, that stock in trade, that, you know, against the party, against Lenin. He hid it in the cupboard. Had he not performed that operation, then the real cooperation with him would have been impossible. The theory of the August Bloc, the theory of unity with Mensheviks, had already been shattered and thrown overboard by the revolution, and we're talking about the revolution of February. For how could there be any talk about unity when an armed struggle was raging between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks in October?
That's right.
So Trotsky had no alternative but to admit that this theory was useless. So I think that I think that the question then comes, we've talked about it already, but what is the purpose of these legends?
Right. Well,
do you have any answer?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because the kernel of it is in what you were just discussing. You have Trotsky saying from, say, 1903 until 1917, unity with the Mensheviks and Bolsheviks, or whenever the first split first took place, unity between them. And then in October, you know, in September, whatever, you have, you know, they're in the streets on opposite sides of the barricades. Well, nobody wants to talk about that anymore. That's too stupid and crazy to bother with. So he revives, you know, he comes up with something new. He synthesizes something else. Then now we've got the division of Leninism, and we've got this theory and that theory and blah, blah, blah. So, but Trotsky's still there dishing up the next thing to confuse the issues that are before the working class. The same with the question of the party principle. The old Trotsky, this is, you know, what Stalin is writing about in 1924, the old Trotskyism tried to undermine the party by means of theory and practice of unity with the Mensheviks. That suffers disgrace. So he says, well, you know what, let's thank you to the old cadres for bringing us where we are. The young party elements now is where the real life and spirit of the revolution is. We should defer to them. And so, you know, the people that have successfully brought us here should now be disregarded. And my nephew over there and his friends in the black jackets, those are the guys we should follow now. You know, that's the kind of thing that goes on. And then the same Stalin writes about on the question of the leaders. And he does the same thing. And Trotsky writes a book on Lenin. And it's a total
miscarriage. That Hitler loves.
Yeah, Hitler loved it. That's right. It's like, you know, it's a joke for anyone that's familiar with the history of it, but this is the kind of thing. As history unfolds and, you know, the bourgeoisie, its agents, you know, those that are familiar with our struggle from the enemy's side need to trot something out, so to speak, to divide the working class and lead those who are going to follow a banner of revolution into a graveyard or gas chamber or falling off the edge of the world. Well, they'll dust off Trotsky, put some new words in his mouth that are market tested, and there'll be plenty of people that are willing to follow it. This is the thing that we have to really educate people about, how to calculate
that,
themselves.
It's interesting that it's in the West where the Trotsky legend operates.
That's right, which is, of course, perfectly sensible when one considers that the West is the home of the global imperialist system. We have to stop there. We'll pick this up next week. Luciano, appreciate your time, as always.
My pleasure, Don, as always.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Redacted Tonight, the show where Americans in America covering American news are called foreign agents. Last week, a hero got sentenced to 3 years in jail. Now, I'm not talking about one of the traditional heroes, like the guy who gets saluted during halftime shows because when he was 18, he went to a country he'd never heard of to shoot at people he'd never heard of, who we're technically not at war with, and he did it all to get... just to get enough money to go to college because college is too f***ing expensive. We all know that's a real hero, all right? I'm not talking about that kind. I'm talking about a climate activism hero. Michael Foster is one of the five climate activists who broke through a chain link fence and in a grotesquely criminal act, they shut off TransCanada's oil flow for a few hours. It was terrible. I mean, look at that. That's some hardened criminals right there, right? That's Pablo Escobar levels right there. That definitely is. For stopping the oil, they got 3 years in jail. However, for actually drilling that oil, destroying our environment, you get sentenced to 0 years in jail. You get sentenced to billions of dollars and private jets and young boys bathing you in a bathtub full of free-range pony tears, all right? That's what you get. Yeah, but I bet those cocktail parties you have to attend if you're that rich are boring as f***, all right? So joke's on you, billionaire oil tycoons! You have boring dinners. This proves our society is backwards. The actions that are illegal versus legal are inverted from what they should be, from an evolved culture. A few weeks ago, nine activists with no more deaths were arrested for leaving jugs of water in the desert to help migrants dying of thirst. That's illegal. They were charged with like littering or something, but it's not illegal to buy up all of our clean water, even near Flint, Michigan. Soon Nestle's gonna have all of our water and we're gonna have to bathe in Coca-Cola or something because there's none left. Have to fill our water beds with small stones. That's not... That's not comfortable. Maybe at that point we'll finally get angry about it. What does illegal even mean anymore? In our land of the free, it's illegal to feed the homeless in some states. According to the National Coalition from the Homeless, for the Homeless, between 2013 and 2015, over 26 cities and communities passed laws restricting the distribution of food to the homeless. Here's a 90-year-old man being taken down to the station for the crime of baked beans, all right? Listen, you may think this is ridiculous, but if you don't stop him now, what's next? Refried beans, huh? Then before you know it, you're involved in some sort of pico de gallo situation. And pico leads to guacamole, and guac opens the gates to cheese, rice, cilantro. So you just thought you were gonna be the cool cop, right? Look the other way, let a few beans slide. That's what you thought. Before you know it, you're dealing with burritos, enchiladas, fajitas, and the salsa's on your hands, all right? It's on your hands. Also illegal. Yeah, it's true. Gets out of control. Snowball. Also illegal, housing the homeless. As we reported on this show, police arrived at a Chicago man's home recently with a warrant and threatened to condemn his property unless he closed his unlawful basement sleeping area. But not illegal, taking blankets away from the homeless. Literally, here is cops. Here are cops taking blankets away from a homeless guy to stop him from sleeping there. Also not illegal, destroying tiny homes built for the homeless. In Denver, the cops did that too. Meanwhile, the banks foreclosed on millions of homes, making millions of families homeless. That's not illegal. We throw out 40% of all food. That's not illegal. And this isn't just what the f's the matter with us kind of situation. It's also a question of freedom. If I were truly free, shouldn't I be free to give somebody whatever the f I want? Shouldn't I be free to give away food and drinks and my Star Wars figurines and two broken umbrellas, three nose hair trimmers, my virginity, my award-winning collection of scabs from around the globe? Shouldn't I be allowed to give away whatever I want? Illegal, living off the grid. In fact, a lot of states consider living off the grid to be camping. And in most places throughout the USA, it is illegal to camp on your own land for more than 2 weeks. That's right, on your own land. What the f*** does that even mean? What if I set up a tent in my living room? Is that illegal? What if I'm not camping? I just happen to be alcoholic and pass out in my yard on a nightly basis, all right? So much so that I started leaving a pillow and blanket and jammies out there. And, you know, you may call it camping, but I call it a regularly scheduled blackout. So is that illegal? So it's illegal to camp in this country, but it's illegal to do that, but it's legal for our military to camp out in Iraq and Afghanistan and Niger, Syria, Germany, Cuba, Djibouti, South Korea, etc., etc., etc. We love camping. Oh, all over the goddamn world. And yet those same ass have the nerve to tell me I can't get a piece of land and live however the hell I want? If I decide I want to live on a 40-foot plot of dirt, wearing underwear on my head, sleeping in the grass, plugging my cell phone and George Foreman grill into some sort of fecal matter power generator, what does it matter to you? That's my life. Illegal, the crime of secretly filming a slaughterhouse. Yes, in some states, people were actually arrested for filming the abuse of farm animals. Not illegal. Abusing farm animals! And you can't film that, but you know what's illegal? Filming every human being in this country at all times. Cameras on every lamppost and street sign. Soon we'll have facial recognition software. We can't do anything anymore. Can't even expose ourselves to a bus full of youngins without being, you know, without being on America's Funniest Home Videos that night. I didn't want to be filmed. I was just doing it for love of the game, right? Our government spies on us constantly at all hours on all our devices, and they tell you it's perfectly legal, see? But you bring home a tape of a piglet getting treated like shit, and somehow that's not permissible because it might harm the profits of the factory farm corporations. Same goes for war crimes, right? You reveal war crimes like Chelsea Manning did, and they're gonna lock you up for a good long time. You commit war crimes like we do on a daily basis, and you can become the Secretary of Defense. Again, he just bombed a wedding party and then bragged he didn't lose any sleep over that decision. If only he'd bombed a daycare, he could be president right now. He could. Come on, General Mattis, believe in yourself. Illegal. Laughing at Jeff Sessions during a Senate hearing. Literally, because that type of free speech is dangerous. On the other hand, it's completely legal to spout full-on propaganda daily on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. You can push for just endless war while being funded by weapons contractors, and it ain't no thing. It ain't. But you slightly guffaw to yourself at an elfish-looking racist while he's under oath saying how much he loves black people, and you get the cuffs slapped on you. Illegal to stage a die-in protest to call attention to people murdered by police. But legal for police to murder people. How does that make any sense? How does that make a goddamn bit of sense? I could go on with these for hours, but here's one more. I was in a plane recently, flying over the middle of the U.S., and I saw something out of my window that stretched for miles, as far as the eye could see. And I was like, what the fuck is that? What in God's name has torn apart the earth like that? And then I figured it out. It's fracking. That's what fracking looks like from above. Just totally destroying and marring up the planet. And I was trying to think, what does that image remind me of? It looks like something. Oh, I know, a virus. It looks like a virus. Like the earth got smallpox or some shit. Our system is a plague on the planet. And if you try to stop that virus, you're arrested, maligned, and repressed. This is the moral collapse of our culture and our criminal justice system. When the sociopathic rulers are this powerful, they use the courts to continue their takeover and extraction. They have captured the traditional fail-safe mechanisms meant to defend against exactly this type of moral inversion. This week, Chris Hedges said, oligarchs cynically view laws as mechanisms to legalize their fraud and plunder. They also use those captured courts to arrest those who try to stop them. While in a jail in Birmingham, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, "One has not only a legal but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws." So get out there, stop the pipelines, reveal the war crimes, and let the Pico de Gallo run free! Coming from Washington, D.C., the Bird of the Beast is in Redacted tonight. Welcome. I'm Lee Camp. Now let's take the news from behind. This week, Israel majorly escalated their involvement in the war on Syria. And now, I think it's getting a bit crowded. It is. You know, before Israel, it was just a nice little romp between Syria, the U.S., ISIS, Al-Qaeda, other various rebel factions, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Turkey. But now, too many chefs in the kitchen. You'll recall that one of the reasons we must bomb the stuffing out of Syria is because the Syrian government has used sarin gas on their own people, chemical weapons. Well, 2 weeks ago, General Mattis sheepishly admitted there's no evidence of use of sarin gas. And to the Washington Post credit, as you see, they got that headline right for once. But here's what CNN ran with. Mattis warns Syria against using chemical weapons. I guess that's one way of saying they haven't used chemical weapons. And from Time.com, the Trump administration just warned Syria not to use chemical weapons. You keep saying chemical weapons. I do not think it means what you think it means. Point is, our media and our ruling elite will manufacture war forever unless we get some anti-war voices in power. Yeah. We have to do that. Luckily, there are actually some bold progressives trying to unseat corporate Democrats across the country, nationwide. There is one problem, though. The DHS. Well, there's probably 99 problems, but DHS is one. The Department of Homeland Security basically took over our voting system when they declared it critical infrastructure at the end of Obama's term. This gives the federal government oversight over storage facilities, polling places, and centralized vote tabulation locations, as well as information and communications technology like voter registration databases, voting machines, and other systems used to manage the election process and report results. Forgive me, but that sounds like all of the things. Because you know, when you're taking a voting system that's ranked worst in the Western world and performed on completely unaccountable machines that no one is allowed to see the code for, and you want to find someone really trustworthy to take control of that, that of course means the Department of Homeland Security. It does. Which is headed by Kirstjen Nielsen, who used to be a principal deputy chief of staff under Donald Trump. You remember Donald Trump? He was like our worst president. You remember that guy? He was awful. And she was special assistant to the president under George W. Bush. Ugh. When your resume says Donald Trump and George W. Bush on it, for your next job, you'd be better off submitting a bloody rotting raccoon head as your resume. All right? That's your resume. From here on, you're better off. You're more likely to get a job. So we've taken our horrible voting system, which I covered extensively on this show in 2016. We took that system and have handed it over to a partisan hack at a ridiculous federal agency. How horrible is the Department of Homeland Security? Well, on this shitty alert chart right here, you can see DHS is currently at orange, high level of shit. But they've got their eye on severe level of shit. They do. But some areas of this country are trying to get away from this craptastic voting system. Pennsylvania wants to move to paper-backed machines, but they can't afford them yet. Well, they're told by their governor that they can't afford them, which is utter bullshit. We can afford anything we really want. If you're on fire, suddenly you can afford water, no matter how much it costs. We should declare an emergency of democracy and allot all of the money in the world to switch to paper ballots until a blockchain system is worked out. Yeah. Right? That's where we have to go. But money's not the only fake problem they're throwing in their path. The directive issued by Governor Tom Wolf was only for the state to buy paperback machines if and when they replace their current stock. Yeah, folks, we will have an accountable election system, but you know, let's not rush into it, okay? Let's keep using these fraudulent fax machines duct taped to a rotary phone welded to a vibrating butt plug that's programmed by the corporations in line with our corporate politicians. Let's keep using those for now, you know, until we happen to be purchasing new machines, and then we'll give this whole real democracy thing a look-see. We have to go to a quick break, but since Facebook, Google, and YouTube are suppressing our content, you can also follow me at steamit.com/@LeeCamp, or you can text the word redacted to 444-999. It's free and quick. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back. Welcome back. As more cities and states pass paid sick leave laws, there are still people who believe it's a death knell for small businesses. Yet they are totally fine with their employees looking like death or spreading it around. Some people just want their listeria infection the same way they want their, you know, craft beer, local. For more on this, we go to our senior sick expert, Natalie McGill. Natalie!
Hey!
Natalie, I can't think of a single good reason to oppose paid sick leave.
I can think of two.
Really?
Yeah. This will force small business owners to A, scale back on other benefits, and B, lay off staff. And you know the American economic engine does not slow down for snot. Plus, with an impending nuclear holocaust, we could all stand to be exposed to a few germs to build a tolerance. My local subway doesn't even use gloves anymore. And once I fill out this punch card, I'll have the immunity of a retired kindergarten teacher.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good plan. It, you know, at my sandwich place, they fired the sneeze guard a bit
while ago. Expect more firings for a small business, especially in Maryland, where lawmakers just approved paid sick leave for 700,000 workers. Even though lobbyists at the National Federation of Independent Business say it's another harmful policy that has more red tape, more record keeping, and devastating sanctions for small businesses.
Natalie, providing paid sick leave makes sense. U.S. employers lose hundreds of billions of dollars in productivity when workers are sick. And then they just spread it around the office. These laws don't restrict their freedoms.
All right, well, if they didn't, why does the Federation fighting these laws get millions in funding from a group called Freedom Partners?
Freedom Partners. Isn't that the Scrooge McDuck money pit backed by the Koch brothers? All that family does is pollute the earth, buy off our politicians, and undermine free speech. There's no reason the National Federation of Independent Business is any less evil than they are. Did you not realize they're Koch-funded?
No, because I've been busy trying to get to 10 punches on this goddamn thing. All right, the only Coke I'm interested in is the fizzy kind coughed on by a seasonal subway employee who skipped a few vaccinations. Plus, would an evil group co-sign a Labor Department proposal for restaurant owners to pool servers' tips together and allow employers to redistribute that money to non-tipped workers, such as cooks and dishwashers? They're experimenting with socialism. Just like young adults experiment in college. Today, it's socialism. Tomorrow, it's vaping meth from a big pen with your organic chemistry professor. Or joining an improv troupe called Americans for some parody. See, they're open to saying yes and to really any ideas, long as it isn't from someone poor, brown, or female, because then the scene kind of dies after that.
Yeah, I mean, why would you listen to them? Anyway, Natalie, the key word, though, is allow. You think employers are actually going to redistribute the money? The right thing to do is just pay all these people more. But corporations are clearly going to pocket this, and we know this because the Labor Department scrubbed analysis that said its proposal would rob billions from the actual workers. Didn't you see that story in your research?
My research. Up until now, I thought Freedom Partners was a political action committee run by people in open relationships. But either way, those are two groups of people who want to have their cake and eat it too.
Natalie McGill, everyone! Moving on, if there's one thing we're good at in this country, it's multitasking. We can take away paid sick leave and meddle in Iran's affairs at the same time. Multitasking. Redacted correspondent Naomi Caravani brings us an update on this raging controversy. We're all sick.
I'm here at the Iranian Embassy, where I heard DC's best parties are. anyone who's anyone is here.
What are you doing? This place has been closed for 40 years.
What? This is bullshit. I thought I was gonna meet Liza Minnelli. Guess I'm a little late.
Again, 40 years late.
All right, I got it. There's no more star-studded soiree, seeing as the notorious embassy closed down in 1979 when, in retaliation for decades of U.S. meddling in their affairs, Islamic revolutionaries took the U.S. embassy in Tehran hostage.
And we have not gotten over it. Now U.S. military bases encircle Iran, and also in America, U.S. citizens with a Persian background find themselves tangled up in this endless international fight. An Iranian American turned down the FBI's request to spy for them and wound up with a prison sentence. Well, that's one way to not take no for an answer. Look, FBI, rejection is a part of life. It's not him. It's you. Accept it. Ahmad didn't want to spy on his employers at the United Nations Iranian mission where he worked as a political consultant. You wouldn't want to find out 12 years later a man you thought you knew had a goal to help the Iranians and the Americans to live in peace. The FBI proposed the spy gig to this Iranian-American academic and yoga enthusiast by detaining him at a hotel for questioning. The agent revealed that Sheikh Zadeh was the subject of a sealed indictment in the Eastern District of New York. When he refused to spy, he was charged with falsifying his tax returns, followed by other more serious accusations, including money laundering and conspiracy to violate U.S. sanctions against Iran. And that was the second dirtiest thing that ever happened at the Jersey City Hyatt. The first was when cadavers were dissected in the hotel ballroom. I'm just wondering if I could get the vegetarian option at this kind of event. You know, I mean an entire vegetarian. After 9/11, the government gave a blank check to the intelligence community. The FBI also mined the UN consultants' phone calls and emails to find evidence of the doctors aiding Iran's nuclear enrichment program, which even the judge found insane. So the prosecutor stressed the severity of the tax violations and asked, "Is it him passing nuclear secrets?" And then he answered his own question by saying, "No, it's not." What a performance. I mean, the FBI and the prosecutors aren't even convinced of their own lies. I know toddlers with more conviction when they deny finger painting the couch. This wasn't Ahmad's first FBI rodeo. He knew what they were up to. In court, he said that over the years, he had had many opportunities to work in the intelligence community, but he refused to secretly spy, he said, because his honor meant more to him than his freedom. Ahmad received 3 months in federal prison for choosing not to spy on his own people. It's either you're with us or you're in jail with all your honor. This case might seem strange in the wake of the Iran nuclear deal. However, the U.S. still behaves as though Iran is the number one enemy of the state. If we want better relations, we're going to have to practice diplomacy instead of being disappointed when everything is not on our terms. I mean, when it comes to Iran, the U.S. is like the ass who's disappointed with the food at an amazing embassy party. Waiter, this is not what I ordered. This is the peace and goodwill towards all men. I clearly ordered the regime change. Reporting from the Iranian embassy, this is Naomi Karavani, redacted tonight.
That's our show, but I have live comedy shows coming up in Austin, Houston, Rochester, New York, Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C., and other cities. Go to redactedtour.com for details or to vote for your city to be added. Until next time, good night, and keep fighting.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.